If you drop by the gift shop of the United States Supreme Court, you will find a cookbook among the items on sale. It's a book with a very personal connection to the court. The spouses of Supreme Court justices put together that cookbook in honor of the late Martin Ginsburg, husband of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. He was a leading tax lawyer and an amateur chef, which is why the book is titled Chef Supreme, Martin Ginsburg. Here's NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg.
The idea for the cookbook came from Martha Ann Alito, wife of Justice Samuel Alito. It hit her the day after Marty Ginsburg's memorial service.
One of my first conversations with Marty in the fall of 2006 was about food and nourishment and how satisfying an expression of love that it was for him. And that also led to the idea that we should put the cookbook together.
The other spouses quickly agreed. They'd often teamed up with Marty to provide the food for the monthly spouse lunches, but none of them had any idea what a large undertaking the cookbook would be. More on that in a minute. But first, a word about Marty Ginsburg's love affair with cooking. It began, strangely enough, when he was in the Army at Fort Sill, Oklahoma, with his new bride, the young Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Neither of the Ginsburgs knew much about cooking then, but one of their wedding gifts was the Escoffier Cookbook, the Bible of French cooking. And so Marty, a chemistry major, began at page one and worked his way through the entire volume. As he observed in a 1996 speech, there was method to his madness.
I learned very early in our marriage that Ruth was a fairly terrible cook and for lack of interest, unlikely to improve. This seemed to me comprehensible. My mother was a fairly terrible cook also. Out of self-preservation, I decided I had better learn to cook because Ruth, to quote her precisely, was expelled from the kitchen by her food-loving children nearly a quarter century ago.
Justice Ginsburg takes umbrage, sort of.
I think that is most unfair to his mother. I considered her a very good cook. In fact, one of the seven recipes that I made was her pot roast.
Over the years, Marty Ginsburg became a genuinely famous amateur cook with a repertoire that ranged from French cooking to Indian to Italian to Asian. So when it came to deciding which recipes to include in the cookbook, the task was daunting. Enter Claire Cushman, Director of Publications for the Supreme Court Historical Society, which is publishing the book on a nonprofit basis.
So, of course, we have appetizers, soups, chicken dishes, fish dishes, meat dishes, desserts, as one would expect. But we were also looking for recipes that really showed his voice.
Cushman and some of her friends and colleagues at work cooked all the recipes they considered, narrowing the list to 106.
You sort of get to know him while you're cooking. The way he wrote his recipes was as if he was explaining them to a friend. I really felt like not only did I trust him that it would come out right, but he was almost with me saying, you know, you can do it. Like, for instance, this passage in the recipe for orange-scented biscotti, he says, knead the dough several times and divide the kneaded dough into two equal parts. This is a miserable, messy, ugly procedure because the dough is horribly sticky. Do your best.
Some of the recipes are quick and easy, others are not. Martha Ann Alito points out that the longest recipe in the book, covering four pages, is the recipe for making French baguettes.
It exemplifies how Marty approached life. Very exacting and very precise.
Justice Ginsburg says it took her late husband more than a year to develop that recipe, experimenting with various approaches.
The reason it spread out on so many pages is that he didn't want to leave out a single step so that the person who uses it won't have to go through the process that he went through to perfect it.
The book also features a variety of gorgeous pictures of food, of all the Supreme Court spouses at lunch, and of the Ginsburg family. Claire Cushman.
Obviously, when you have a recipe called Grandchildren's Chocolate Chip Oatmeal Cookies, you want to have a picture of all the grandchildren with Justice Ginsburg.
But the pièce de résistance is a photo of Marty Ginsburg wearing a classic French cooking apron with his arm around Justice Ginsburg, who is dressed in her judicial robe. Again, Claire Cushman.
The best part about it is the way he looks at her with just such an adoring gaze. And anyone who sees this cover knows that she was a very lucky woman.
The Martin Ginsburg Cookbook is available online at supremecourthistory.org or at the Supreme Court gift shop. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
And the picture Nina mentioned, along with some of the recipes, are at NPR.org.
Now to Milwaukee, Wisconsin, the home of listener Christine Bilkey. When we recently asked you about to tell us about foods you enjoy during the holidays, Bilkey told us about a traditional Norwegian porridge called rømmegrøt.
Rømmegrøt is a cream pudding that is cooked over a double boiler for pretty much the whole day. And then we put it in small dishes and cover it with melted butter and cinnamon and sugar, and then we eat it as an appetizer.
Sounds perfect for a cold, wintry day. As with many dishes brought over from the old country, the Bilkey family has tweaked the recipe.
I think traditional rømmegrøt is made with just cream and flour, but we use rice instead of flour to thicken it. I have no idea when that started, and I have no idea why, but that's the way my family has always made it.
Christine Bilkey says it's the first thing her mother puts on the stove for holiday meals, and as it simmers, more cream is added to the mixture throughout the day.
It's a great dish for a time when you're in the kitchen cooking all day anyway, because you just put it on the back burner and it cooks all day and it doesn't take a whole lot of extra to be able to cook it and have it ready.
With all that cream, you hardly know whether to eat it or rub it on. If you would like to try rømmegrøt, you can find the recipe for this and other holiday dishes at NPR.org. You're listening to Morning Edition from NPR News.
Holiday spending is up a little bit this Christmas season, but many people remain on tight budgets, and the truth is that many of us don't like spending too much at Christmas anyway, which doesn't mean we don't want to enjoy it. And that's where Nigella Lawson comes in. She's offering us some suggestions from her book, Nigella Christmas, on how to do Christmas pleasantly on a budget. She's a regular guest on this program, a TV chef. Hi, Nigella.
Hello.
And welcome back once again. Let's start, I suppose, with an appetizer. You have a recipe here for, well, potato skins.
I do, and I have to say straight away that these recipes came to me just out of greed, not out of budgetary concerns. And I think in a way this is quite important because, you know, one should always try and do food that is just as good as any luxury dish would be. Mm-hmm. And actually, so they are potato skins. They're my fully loaded potato skins. And this time of year it makes sense because I think you need a lot of carbohydrate.
Okay.
Maybe unfashionable, but it's cold and maybe you're drinking a lot. But this is quite strange because I'm giving you back a recipe that I got via America. So it's really my thank you present.
Oh, this is a very American dish, potato skins.
It really is. And so really it's just a question of, you know, baking potatoes, splitting them in half, taking out all that, you know, soft cooked potato meat. Mm-hmm. And then let the potato meat get cold, or flesh maybe is really one of the meat. You let that get cold. You let the husks sort of dry out a little so that they become vessels for eating the rest of the potato later. I let them dry out because the great thing about this, you can do most of it in advance, well, all of it. And then on the day you've got your friends coming over, I like sour cream and some grated cheese and maybe some scallions and a bit of Worcestershire sauce. Now, I pop those back into their skins and put them in the oven. Now, I actually like them with bacon as well. So I think you either can do the little bacon bits and put them on top, or you can put them in cute little bowls for people to pass around.
Now, you said that greed attracts you to these particular dishes. Is that partly because some of the simpler dishes, the less expensive dishes, you can just make more and more and more of it?
Well, I suppose so, but I do think that really, at key times of the year, like the holidays, what one really wants are the simpler, more traditional foods. I don't know that I want anything giddyingly fancy. Mm-hmm. And I think also food tends to have to be multi-generational. So it's absolutely pointless cooking something that if you've got a 7-year-old and a 70-year-old, you know, you want to make everyone happy.
Mm. I wonder if this lasagna that you've suggested here would have the same effect.
Well, the lasagna I adore, and it's a pumpkin and goat's cheese lasagna. I love this because it not only is, you know, vegetarians like it, which isn't obviously my main concern as a meat eater, but again, it's something you cook ahead. And obviously, if you're dispensing with meat, you're probably doing away with the most expensive part of any meal. But there's something so festive about this. I suppose a huge tray of lasagna always is pretty festive, but the scent of the spiced pumpkin and that sharpness of the cheese, and it creates a slight lake at the bottom, so you have to give people bread to mop it up. And even though it's a pumpkin lasagna, if it's easier for you to chop up some butternut squash, I mean, by all means do that. I'm pretty easygoing about that. But the reality is, it's very basic. There's sweet and there's sharp, and then there's the tangy sauce, and then, of course, that incredible comforting smoothness of a lasagna. And I don't make my own pasta here, though I could, and I would encourage anyone to, but I would also encourage anyone who hasn't got the time to buy some soft, as it were, fresh lasagna, so you don't have to pre-boil it.
So isn't it time, maybe past time, for a drink?
I know. I wondered when you were going to offer me something to drink, or whether I asked me to offer you one.
Oh, please.
Okay, do you want to know, this is what I give everyone before they come for lunch on the 25th of December, and was very useful one year because one of my ovens broke, and so that lunch was at 4 rather than at 2.
Oh.
And it's called, I call it a poinsettia, because obviously it's a very seasonal plant, and this is a red drink. And I will give you the wherewithal to make it, and make one bottle of fizz, you know, stretch. So it's delicious, but I'm going to pretend now it's just really, really good economical sense, which it is, but that's secondary. You're not having to go out and buy, you know, 8 different liqueurs.
It's straightforward.
It's straightforward. So you have a bottle of Prosecco, any fizzy dry wine, doesn't have to be premium. And then for that, half a cup of any orange liqueur, which you can get pretty well. Orange liqueur is not a fancy one. And then 2 cups of cranberry juice. Now, if you wanted to, there's nothing to stop you really missing out, you know, the orange liqueur. It would still be delicious, but let me tell you, with the orange liqueur in it, not only is it fantastic, but the dangerous thing is it doesn't taste alcoholic. Oh. I'm just warning everyone now.
Have 4 or 5 before you know what you're
doing. All I can say is no one even noticed lunch was 2 hours late when my oven broke. And that is the truth.
Oh, that's great. Now, let's move on to one more thing here. We've still got a little bit of room for some gingerbread.
I think you have to have gingerbread, not least it smells so wonderful. You know, the ginger, cinnamon, cloves, molasses, butter. Oh, it's so delicious. But the reality is with this gingerbread is it's very easy because you make it all in a pan. So you're not actually creaming anything. You just put all the relevant ingredients into a saucepan. You know, you heat it and then stir everything together. And then I throw everything into, I use a foil tin because it's easier. You can store the gingerbread in it afterwards as well. And you just bake it for about, I don't know, 45 minutes, 60 minutes, depending on how hot your oven runs. Mm-hmm. And if you can bear it, you know, leave it for a day or two and it will get stickier and stickier. But it's so wonderful just with a cup of tea or coffee. And of course, it doesn't hurt at this time of year to have something you could take over to friends where you're visiting.
So will you be making this sticky gingerbread for your guests this Christmas?
Always. Absolutely always. And also, even though it's completely like going into a different register, because after all, ginger is the taste of the tropics, it's a fantastic, if you want to upscale it somewhat to a dinner party dessert, I get some cube mangoes and cube them and serve that with it. And then a little bit of dusting of, you know, if you dust a bit of powdered sugar through a sieve on top of anything, it suddenly looks more expensive. That's what you do.
Nigella Lawson, it's always a pleasure talking with you.
And you.
Her many books include Nigella Christmas, and you can find recipes for pumpkin goat cheese lasagna and sticky gingerbread at npr.org. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
For decades, young people have been leaving farms behind. The average age of the American farmer keeps rising. It's now 55. But recently, there's been a small surge in the other direction. Young people who've never farmed before are trying it out. NPR's Dan Charles went to find out why.
I should admit right away, I'm one of those people who left the family farm. Maybe the problem was I never went to a gathering of young farmers quite like this one. It's the 4th annual Young Farmers Conference put on by the Stone Barn Center for Food and Agriculture in Tarrytown, just north of New York City. 200 young men and women, more women than men, in fact, are dancing and clapping and laughing into the night. They're in their 20s and 30s. Some of them have their own farms. Some are working for other farms as apprentices for a year or two. Some are just thinking about it. They came here to learn new skills and meet each other. Earlier today, there were seminars on soil fertility, managing sheep, how to find affordable land. Now, it's time for the folk dancing. The Stone Barn Center is a gorgeous place, a country estate that once belonged to the Rockefellers. There really are stone barns here, also a high-end restaurant. These days, it's devoted to a new kind of farming, organic, environmentally conscious, supplying people nearby. That's what attracts the people to this conference. They're a new breed of farmer. Most of them are children of the cities and suburbs. They went to college. Now they want to grow vegetables or feed pigs. I keep asking them, why?
Essentially, it just was sort of born out of a concern for the environment. I spent the first 2 years of college with one question in mind, basically, how can I have the greatest impact in my life in the world? And so the thing that I kept coming back to that played the largest role that everyone connected to was food.
That's Brian Bates. Some of these farmers talk about what they want to accomplish farming. Others say they love the work itself, like Liz Moran and Roger Phillips.
Yeah, it's never a question for me. I mean, I feel lost when I'm not farming, when I'm not out in the field, and it's, you know, where I find the most peace and harmony in my life, and that's, I guess, what we're here for.
I love being outside. I mean, when I look, you know, I look around and, you know, you're amongst the plants in the sunshine, and that's my office, that's where I want to be.
Some like the feeling of doing something practical, like Kristen Carbone.
Having a skill was really important to me, having studied political science. I wanted to do something that I could, that was productive, that was real, and have a real skill, and to be able to provide, you know, my family or my community with something, a vital element.
And then there's Lindsay Shute.
How did I get into farming? Primarily because I started dating a farmer.
Nobody really told me they're doing it to make money. This is an idealistic crowd. Some describe their farming as a kind of protest against the idea that success means a big paycheck, against big corporations. Lindsay Shute's husband, Ben, has been running his own farm for 10 years now. He says the great thing about it is it's a really practical kind of idealism.
It's all well and good and important to, you know, have political opinions and to protest and things like that, but when you're farming, you can kind of live your values and kind of, you know, farm the world you want to see.
Nobody knows how many young farmers like this there are. They certainly don't produce more than a tiny sliver of the country's food, but they do seem to be part of a real social movement. Organic farmers who used to spend part of the winter recruiting workers for the next summer now are turning people away. This conference, which started 4 years ago, has been selling out months ahead of time. But along with the enthusiasm, I also heard some uncertainty and anxiety about not making enough money, about settling in one place for good. And it's hard work for not much pay. A lot of the young farmers said their parents wish they were doing something else. It made me wonder whether they'll really be able to stick with it. So I looked up a real old-timer of the local organic food movement, Jim Crawford.
We had a huge day today. Everybody bought everything out.
Crawford runs New Morning Farm in south-central Pennsylvania. On weekends, he gets up at 4 in the morning and brings vegetables to a market here in Washington, D.C. When Crawford looks at today's new generation of would-be farmers, he sees himself when he was younger.
It was exactly the same things in my head 40 years ago, exactly the same.
In 1972, Crawford was in law school in Washington, D.C. and working on Capitol Hill, but not really enjoying it that much. Through happenstance, he ended up running a vegetable garden in West Virginia one summer. He really enjoyed it and got more serious about it, but soon the summer was over.
And I didn't really want to go back to law school in the city and everything, but I knew I had to, so I went back, and I walked into that law school, and I said, no, I'm just not going to do this. I'm going to go the other way. So I just walked back out and went back out there.
He went back to the thing he was ready to throw himself into. And he's been doing it ever since, even though it hasn't always been one big happy folk dance.
I can remember feeling kind of desperate and just having many failures, and a lot of failures. I mean, in the first couple of years of growing crops and not really knowing what I was doing, you know.
But there's one thing he had, a big reason why he's still farming. He loved the business side of it, finding customers, making a living on his own. So that's what he now preaches to his apprentices today. Hang on to your ideals, he says. That's important, but try to be just as serious about earning a profit.
You know, I do it for basically idealistic reasons, but if you're going to stick with it and you expect to make a living at it, you've got to be realistic about the business aspects and the money and managing money and borrowing money and all the things that a business person has to do. And you have to accept that and learn to like that somewhat at least and be willing to be good at that, you know.
That may mean compromises, he says. Maybe it means burning a little more fossil fuel to get your vegetables to a city where people pay higher prices. That's okay, Crawford says, making trade-offs, but holding on to what's most important, that's what growing up is all about. Dan Charles, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered.